Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
The same was true of Outnumbered when they did the sort of taster film for that. They went, do you want to come and do this? It's on a Saturday morning. There's literally no money. Can you bring your own clothes? You know, and we'll film it. And there is. So I was sitting there in this makeup chair next to Michael Hutchence, who, as far as I could work out, he was on a mobile phone for most of the time, and he seemed to be buying a ranch in Montana. That's what I could work out. They couldn't decide whether I was going to be shot in the head or shot in the chest, but they did know I was going to be shot. So I had to practice different types of death. So I was ready when it came to it. The pitch was, we don't bother to research your dead relatives, we talk to them.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is an actor, writer, comedian, impressionist and presenter who also appeared on every single episode of Mock the Week for 17 years. You may also know him as Pete from Outnumbered, Toby from Not Going Out, or the kindly bank manager from Fleabag. He even made a brief appearance in the last Bond movie, No Time to Die. The son of a priest and a school teacher, he was raised in Mill Hill, London, where his father worked as a vicar before going on to become a bishop. A super bright child, he went on to study at Cambridge, where he worked so hard he earned the nickname Desk, took a first in geography and was approached by MI5 to be a spy, even sitting a preliminary interview where he decided it wasn't for him after being told that he'd be expected to, quote, do people over. Instead, he joined Footlights and took a job for 6 years at Unilever as a brands manager for Lynx body spray upon graduating, all the while performing in the evenings with his Cambridge comedy partner Steve Punt, and only resigning from his day job when he and Steve had their Radio 1 show, The Mary Whitehouse Experience, commissioned as a BBC Two television show. Since then, he's continued to work with Steve for the last 25 years on Radio 4's The Now Show, appeared in a string of dramas, sitcom, panel shows, and has presented Channel 4's The Great British Dig, where he and a team of archaeologists dig for treasure in, well, effectively, people's back gardens. But all of that's on hold this month as he heads out on his first live tour for 10 years with Steve on their We Are Not a Robot tour. A father of two grown-up children from his second marriage, for the last 7 years, he's been in a relationship with his former Outnumbered on-screen wife, the actress Claire Skinner, and they live in London. So let's dial him in. A man with a very storied career. It's Hugh Dennis. So listen, Hugh, ready to hit the road in a matter of days now as I speak to you on this spring-like April morning. For the first time in 10 years with Steve, it's like the Stones have got back together again, sort of.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite on the scale of the Stones, I don't think. It's very nice of you to say so. Yeah, no, we haven't toured since 2014. And then, but before that, we hadn't toured for 7 years, I think. I mean, we just don't tour very often.
So tell me, these days, when you and Steve go out on the road, what does your rider look like compared to the last time you toured?
Well, our rider is incredibly simple. I think it says some water, please, and some fruit.
basically a doctor's waiting room.
I mean, that is literally it. But we've seen lots of other people's writers because they leave them in dressing rooms and things. They're sort of around the place. But we've never got to saying we need two new mountain bikes every evening, you know, every venue.
A Peloton.
And we've got to have... Listen, we demand that the theatre in Yeovil be redecorated before we arrive. No, it's literally just, yeah, give us some snacks, not too much sugar. Maybe a beer, and that's it, and a kettle. That's what we really need, a kettle.
So listen, we are not robots, right? Is this a swan song? Because 25 years of presenting and working on the Now Show, and it's coming to an end. So does the tour hold hands with the show as you sort of wave goodbye to it?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, we've known that this is the last series of The Now Show for about 2 years, so we decided that we would tour. So they're linked in that way. But I don't think it's a swan song, because, again, I sort of absolutely believe that you should live your life looking forwards rather than backwards as much as you can, right? So we're leaving years and years and years of sort of topical comedy behind, but we're not leaving comedy behind.
No, and there is a new show I should point out.
Moving on to other stuff, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just, it's just another step on the way, really. I mean, you probably feel this yourself, actually, that careers really only make sense when you look at them backwards. You never quite...
Totally.
You can never know quite what you're going to do. And then when you look back or you read your own Wikipedia entry, which isn't something I would ever advise, by the way.
Don't do it.
Because amongst other things, they get my date of birth wrong, as far as I remember. The, it just makes... It seems that it's all this sort of seamless thing that just sort of happens and was inevitable that you were going to move from this show to this show. And you go, it didn't feel like that at the time at all.
Well, that's really interesting you say that, actually, because as much as you're insistent on looking forward, I really wanted to dive in for my first question with you to a little bit of CV bingo, because your CV it's storied, it's varied, and I think it speaks hugely of the multiple interests that you hold. So are you okay with that?
Yeah.
So all I'm going to do is just shout out some of the shows that you've worked on, and maybe just give me, you know, the first thing that comes to your mind, like your instant kind of recall as to what that experience meant to you. And let's kick off with the Mary Whitehouse experience.
Yeah, which it was amazing. I mean, it was a sort of an amazing thing to be part of, the Mary Whitehouse experience. But it came, the Mary Whitehouse experience that people kind of remember, I think, was when it was on BBC Two, and it was,
yeah.
We only ever did 13 of them, I think. But before that, and the reason it happened at all, was because it was the first comedy on Radio 1. And we did, I seem to remember, we did 48 shows in 18 months or something on Radio 1. And then it transferred to BBC Two. But it was ridiculous. I mean, it was, you know, we've talked about riders and stuff like that, but it was slightly like being a kind of sort of minor rock star for a year. It was great. It was absolutely amazing.
You cooked the show up with, obviously, Steve, your partner in comedy and all things crime, but also David Baddiel and Rob Newman.
Yeah. Yeah, but we sort of, we had all worked together on a show, as far as I remember, called... Hey Radio, which again was on, Radio 1. And there was the producer of it was a guy called Bill Dare. And Bill Dare just decided that we all could, I don't know whether it's sort of a testament to talent or not, but I think it was more of a testament to they can sort of get the job done because you've got to write and perform stuff week by week. So I think he kind of went, these four people could do it. And Rob and Dave weren't really a double act, but Steve and I were a double act. And he just lumped us together and let us get on with it.
Isn't that kind of joyous, though? I mean, we had recently, we had Lee Francis on the show, and he said that Paramount Comedy Channel had done much the same, where they'd just kind of thrown together this sort of petri dish of bright young things. So in the development team, they had Sacha Baron Cohen, Dom Jolly, Lee Francis, Noel Fielding, Jessica Hines, and Simon Pegg. You know, and it sounds a bit like you were kind of in a similar vortex.
Yeah, no, absolutely, completely. And, you know, one of the star of Hey Radio, which was the start of all of it, as host of Hey Radio, was Patrick Marber, who's one of Britain's sort of top playwrights. Now, I mean, it was a really, really sort of exciting time. And it was a kind of time where there were lots of opportunities that hadn't previously existed. So the sort of Radio 1 thing was great. And then, you know, we were at a sort of transitional period between two different types of comedy almost. It was sort of the leaving of the old guard and the arrival of the new. And we, you know, right place, right time, wasn't it?
Wonderful. And also that the kind of, you know, a whiff of the rock star about it all as well, because you're on Radio 1.
Yeah. And during that time, actually after that, sort of at the very beginning of the 1990s, and I still find it sort of amazing to think that this ever happened, for one week only, Steve and I presented Top of the Pops. I can't think of anybody less likely to present Top of the Pops. But we did it. Just one week. And in that week...
How was it? How was it for you?
It was sort of amazing. It was a period when they suddenly decided that they needed the presenters to be slightly more funny. So we did a week. I think Joe Brand did a week. I think Jack D did a week. Angus Deaton did a week. But on our week, it was... the number one was Wigfield, if you remember Wigfield.
And it'd be number Saturday one. Night. Yeah.
Yes.
La da dee da da da.
Sort of everywhere. Yeah, exactly. Proper kind of Europop sort of thing. And it'd been number one for about 3 months right through that summer. But on the same show was In Excess were on. And I found myself sitting next to Michael Hutchence in makeup. And I was dressed as this sort of. I was dressed as this character I played on the Mary Whitehouse Experience called Mr. Strange. Whose main characteristic was he sort of was obsessed by milk. Right, anyway, so I was sitting there in this makeup chair next to Michael Hutchence, who was far... I mean, we didn't really talk very... We sort of nodded politely to each other and said hello. But as far as I could work out, he was on a mobile phone for most of the time and he seemed to be buying a ranch in Montana. That's what I could work out. Just earwigging. He was certainly buying some very large bit of real estate somewhere. And I've never felt like more of an idiot. I was just sort of... It was like I was a comedian with a revolving bow tie and this sort of flashing red nose sitting next to this sort of rock god in makeup. And on the same show... So embarrassing, thinking about it. And on the same show was Cyndi Lauper. And then top of the bill was Elton John. All in this sort of same week at Top of the Pops. Presented by... Me and Steve.
That's he was great, Mr. Strange, like saying milky, milky.
That... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, milky, milky. But it's one of those things where you think, no one can ever take that away. I did that. Amazing.
Totally. I think I'd put in some shifts before you, before they decided that they needed funny people, because I definitely wasn't in that era. But I also hosted Top of the Pops for a couple of years, and it never failed to be a gobsmacking experience. Never more so than when, like, at lunchtime, you'd be in the canteen at Elstree queuing up for, like, you know, a salad with Bono and Peggy Mitchell.
Yeah, collision of worlds.
Because it was the only place you could get food, so everyone had to go there.
Yeah, but they're just sort of fantastic. There used to be all BBC sitcom used to rehearse at North Acton in a building that's now become part of the Carphone Warehouse. But it was sort of amazing. And there was a canteen there. And you were kind of in different teams, really. But we used to rehearse Mary Whitehouse there. And in another room, there was sort of French and Saunders. And in another room, they were doing, you know, sort of some big old style sitcom, and it was great. It's a real sort of, it's great when you meet people sort of doing the same thing but in different bits. Yeah. And how did Doc Cotton get on with?
Oh my God, listen, there were so many great stories, but Doc Cotton particularly was a huge hit with a lot of the rock stars because they all found her obviously to be quite iconic. And people would go and seek out the EastEnders lot. You know, you would find literally Bono going, "Oh my God, look, it's Arthur Fowler." You're like, "I know, come on. You're number one. It's still number one. It's Top of the Pops. Let's crack on." But wonderful times. I'm glad you had that experience because you're quite right. Mm. No one can ever take that away from you. The same could be said for a job that you got called up for, a read-through on, which went on to become hugely important to a whole new generation of people that probably had no idea about Milky Milky, Doctor Strange and all the other stuff that you'd done, and that's Fleabag. Talk to me about how that came to be, because your work on that was pretty epic, actually. You know, you were really rather marvellous, if I may say.
Thank you. So Fleabag, I don't know quite how it happened, really. I just got asked... I just got asked to go and do the read-through. I think Phoebe just, you know, found who my agent was and asked to go and do the read-through. And it was, at that point, it was at the stage of they were selling it to BBC Two. And you think, you know, it's another example, actually, which is also true of Outnumbered, which I suspect you'll get on to later. But there was, in both of those instances, there's the kind of thing where there are so many reasons to turn it down, you know, at the point of inception. So when Fleabag came along, it was kind of, you know, do you want to come to an old church hall in Bloomsbury and read through this thing in front of the commissioning editor of BBC Two? And you actually go, well, yeah, that'd be great. Because I generally go, that's great. But you could equally well go, oh, nah. Come on, that's a long way, isn't it? And I don't know. And the same was true of Outnumbered, when they did the sort of taster film for that. They went, "Do you want to come and do this? It's on a Saturday morning. There's literally no money. Can you bring your own clothes? You know, and we'll film it." And there are so many reasons.
Are you serious?
Well, yeah. And you go, sorry, that was very high pitched and unmasculine sounding. Going on there.
I'll take it.
But actually, it's a really good lesson in the sense that, you know, I sort of operate on the principle that you should pretty much always go, yeah, no, that sounds really interesting, I'll do that. But on Fleabag was amazing, and I'm sort of amazingly grateful to, you know, Phoebe for thinking of me and asking me to do it. And it was a really, really good thing for me, because it was the sort of part that I hadn't really, you know, it was sort of funny and it was sort of tragic all at the same time. It was the kind of thing I hadn't really done before.
Totally. And awkward and painful and pained at times. And then, you know, there's the scene where the two of you are sat smoking and you talk about this kind of wistful, regretful, regret-fueled monologue that you deliver, which culminates in you saying that you wish you'd, like, you know, enabled your wife to orgasm more. I mean, it goes to places that you just don't see or predict. And I thought it was really wonderful, powerfully written and beautifully delivered.
Yeah, no, but I mean, really, really beautifully written, actually. Really beautifully written. And it was, again, it was one of those... it was a show where you sort of had to kind of accept that when you went in, having learnt lines, and this happened on both series, actually, that I'd turn up and I'd go, right, I've learnt them, Phoebe. And she went, now that's a shame, because we're going to rewrite them now. And they would go off. You know, we filmed it. It was, the unit base was a pub, actually, for quite a lot of it in... sort of in North London. It's quite a nice place to sort of be sitting, but they'd say, give us 20 minutes and we're just going to... We don't feel it sort of develops this side of your character quite enough, so they go away and they just rewrite it. And actually, I'm very... You know, that's a really nice way of working, actually, because there was such a sort of level of care about every aspect of that programme. It was sort of great in all sorts of aspects.
Yeah, and brave. and really bold, actually. And it required everybody to bring their A game and be as flexible as that, which is turn up word perfect straight off the book and then go, no, we're burning the book. We're going again.
Yeah.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
But you are no stranger to improv. I mean, you did every single episode of Mock the Week for how many years?
That, I think, was 17 years.
Jeez,
that's a lot of weeks.
You, for somebody that still feels the fear about being self-employed, you've had some incredibly long-standing jobs. 17 years on Mock the Week, 25 years on The Now Show. Like, what's your problem?
I know. Well, you know, it's... and actually, when these things move, when these things go, you know, you could kind of go, oh, it's so... that's unfair, isn't it? And you actually look back and you go, no, that's unbelievable. Nobody gets 17
unbelievable.
Years on a single show or 25 years on Radio 4, really. You know, I've been very, very lucky.
But also very curious, because you've at a time when people were constantly encouraged to stay in their lane, you've definitely not done that. I mean, right down to, you know, the work that you do as an actor, but also presenting shows like The Great British Dig, which we find you as this kind of, you know, bystanding enthusiast whilst people's gardens are pulled apart looking for, you know, Roman pebbles or something. But you love it, don't you?
I think that's the thing, really. I'm sort of, I think I always have been interested in almost everything, actually. You know, I sort of feel like I could talk to someone about plugs for quite a long time.
But again, you know, a lot of people might, when their agent calls up and says, listen, you know, Channel 4 have been in touch. We want you to do this show. It's called The Great British Dig, because everything at the moment is being called The Great British Something. And do you fancy it? And you go, you could have easily just gone, no.
You could, but you do. I mean, you do get a no to lots of things, because you're sort of aware that lots of things are sort of wouldn't suit. So you have, you know, there's a certain amount of quality control going on. I got asked once to do a show, which was, the sales pitch for it was that it was a combination of whatever that show is called, So Haunted or So Haunt Me, whatever, with Derek Acora. So it was a sort of combination of that.
Most Haunted.
Most Haunted, there you go. And Who Do You Think You Are? And the pitch was, we don't bother to research your dead relatives. We talk to them. And you go, right, okay.
Amazing, did you do it?
I'm not sure, no. Because I just thought that sounds... Maybe I should have done. It just sounded...
You should
sort
have
of,
done.
Just sounded terrible. I mean, really... You know, in all sorts of ways. And actually not really that interesting. I mean, if you got to talk to your great-grandfather, I suppose he'd tell you lots of interesting things. How could you be sure it was indeed your great-grandfather?
Because you've got the powerful Derek Acora there guiding you into the spirit world. Come on now.
Yeah.
That's not
and doing
trust.
That amazing sort of change of going, and then, and then speaking.
But you actually did do Who Do You Think You Are? So what did you learn about who you come from?
Well, I didn't... if I'm perfectly honest, I didn't discover that much. Not in terms of relatives, anyway, that I didn't already know, really. So I think Who Do You Think You Are sort of divides into two different types of shows. So one is where you discover that you're your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great great-grandfather was a centurion who built Hadrian's Wall, and everybody goes, oh, that's amazing. Or it's used
or a king
as a
and
of,
related to Danny Dyer. Yeah, remember that king. One? That was great.
Yeah, Danny
that was
Dyer. Yeah, it's great. Or they use it as a means of explaining a bit of history that's kind of interesting. And I think that's what my one was, really. So my one was about, you know, you send all this, they do all the research. And what there's this sort of thing in my family where we go, one branch of the family comes from Somerset, and there's always been a sort of a kind of legend in our family that actually we are the rightful heirs to this place called Montacute House in Somerset. Anyway, you do this, and you're kind of keeping your fingers crossed that this is true. It's nonsense. It's never.
Ah.
Nothing. No trace of that at all. Or you want to discover something amazing. Literally nothing amazing was discovered. But so what it ended up being was the story of my two grandfathers who had both fought in the First War, and neither of them ever talked about it. And it was kind of trying to work out what sort of wars they'd had. And the way it turned out was that my mother's dad, and I knew both these men. I mean, this is what's really silly about it, because I could just...
Oh, right.
You know, why I don't want to ask my deceased great-great-great-grandfather what happened to him through a medium. I could actually have just spoken to my grandfather and said, what was the First World War like for you? But, you know, you don't think about it.
No, you don't.
And my mother's father had a terrible war. So he had fought in, like, three or four of the worst battles of the First World War. And he'd been in for, you know, 2.5 years on the front line. And he then had terrible post-traumatic stress, which has affected the rest of his life and all the rest of it. So he didn't talk about it because he'd been so badly affected by it. And then my father's father, the war ended on November the 11th, 1918. And he joined up at the beginning of 1917 or something, but he only made it to the front on November the 6th, 1918. So he had a war that lasted 5 days. But on the second day of his war, he was shot in the shoulder. So he then came back. And I think he didn't talk about it, probably because he was sort of slightly embarrassed by the fact that he was surrounded by all these people who'd had sort of terrible wars and stuff. So he didn't really ever talk about it. And this is a much longer answer than you were thinking you were going to get.
No, absolutely. No, I love it. Because I think it teaches us so much about never judging books by their covers, right? Especially ones that I've chosen not to speak. You must have felt that you learned an awful lot about the men that you thought you knew that you really probably didn't.
No, I mean, but you... it was very, very interesting, actually. But it's odd that my grandfather, for example, taught me to catch. I mean, my memories of him are just him chucking a ball at me and me diving across the garden. You know, and yet he had had this terrible, terrible, terrible war that he just didn't speak about because you never did.
No, I don't think. I think that was the story for many, 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 many men that returned from the front line.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Can we dive into my next question for you?
Yeah.
You made it to Cambridge, where you earned the nickname Desk because you worked so hard.
Yeah.
Such a studious young man. And had a great experience at Cambridge. You ended up also being approached by MI5 at one point with a view to you joining them, a view you clearly didn't share. And told them no thanks after they told them that you would be expected to do people over. Is that right?
Well, it was a rather, you know, again, it was a sort of rather different world. I mean, now you apply for jobs, don't you, in MI5? You actually have to go through you reply to adverts and things. But at that world, in that time, so this was like the mid-80s, I suppose, you got approached by your tutor or whoever. There was obviously a network of people who were asking And I was approached, and I went down. Because again, you think it's sort of slightly flattering, don't you? Or you're thinking, oh, that'd be really interesting. I wonder what an interview for that will be like. So I went down and I had this interview, at the end of which I thought, I guess it really isn't me, I don't think. Because on the one hand, you go, you know, it is sort of flattering to be approached, because you think, oh, what have they seen in me that I, what are they talking about? And you go down. But then, on the other hand, you know, spying isn't being James Bond. Spying, as far as I could see, actually, was about disappearing into a crowd and no one ever really noticing you. And I think deep inside me, I thought, no, actually, I want to be noticed, I think. I think I need another kind of career where I can be noticed. So it was never a sort of serious thing, but I went to just see what it would, you know, what it was like, really. It's amazing that was the system, though, isn't it?
Yeah. But I wonder, when else in life has a kind of opportunity that you never saw coming landed at your feet? Because so much of what we've just discussed by way of your CV would suggest that that's been quite a common occurrence.
Yeah, well, I think it was right at the start, actually, of this kind of career, because I never ever intended to do what I do now. I'd never even thought of it. And when I got into Cambridge, I got in with sort of A-level result. I got ABE in my A-levels.
ABE? What was the E?
It was physics. I thought, I was convinced it was a B and that the printer had gone wrong on the results sheet. And because they're in capitals, aren't they? I thought they've just missed the sort of curly ends. I mean, it's definitely a B. I think I've been predicted an A. But anyway, got an E.
And you got you where you needed to go.
But the school sent off for a remark, and the letter came back which went, no, it is still an E. But, you know, if it's any comfort, it was a very high E. For almost a D.
No comfort.
No comfort at all. But that's why when I got to Cambridge, I thought that I must be amongst the most sort of, you know, the least intelligent people there. And it took me, and that's why I worked so hard, because I thought, you're in the wrong place, really. Someone's going to find you out. I'm just going to have to get my head down and work. So I worked really hard, got the nickname Desk.
It's a great name.
I know,
it's a great name.
Yeah. My Sue Perkins and Mel Gedroych just call me Desk all the time. They weren't even at college with me, but they just called me.
I noticed that. I listened to a podcast you'd done with Mel, and she kept calling you Desk, which is how I know about this name, because I thought, what the hell is that all about? There you go.
So I got their feeling I sort of shouldn't really be there. But then in the second year, I kind of looked around and I thought, no, you're not. I think you're all right, actually. I think this is okay. I think this is fine. It's all fine. So I started doing other things. I'd always played a lot of sport. So I played a lot of sport at Cambridge. But I, you know, a friend of mine said, there is this thing called footlights. Do you want to go and do it? And I went, I'd never heard of them. I mean, it was mad. I'd never heard of Cambridge footlights. They were sort of very famous at that point. So I went along and did it. And I did it for a year. And then at the end of university, there were sort of like three of us, I suppose, who were still interested in carrying on with it in that particular group. And that was Nick Hancock, who, you know, did They Think It's All Over and sort of all that kind of stuff. And Steve Punt and me.
Yeah.
But I wasn't and then Steve said, do you fancy doing... I know you applied for a proper job, which I had, with Unilever, who are this vast multinational, you know, and I got on their marketing program. And when I'd started that, and I was the brand manager of Lynx deodorant, body spray for men.
As the mother of a teenage boy, I'm familiar with your work.
I know, I'm really sorry.
Thanks for the smell of Africa.
Yeah, he said, do you fancy being a double X? You know, and the unsaid part of that was, it's much easier being a double act because you've got someone to talk about how, you know, terrifying it is. So that's what we did. And about 18 months after starting that, And I was only doing it at weekends. I mean, I was literally doing a comedy store on a Saturday night and Friday night. And the rest of the time I was, you know, doing the Lynx Effect from my office. Jasper Carrot came down to the comedy store and said, do you want to do the show? Do you want to be in my show on BBC One? Which was live. It was a live show. And he was worried that he wouldn't have enough stuff.
Wow.
So he asked us to write a sketch a week. And Steve's head went, that's brilliant, that's 13 million billion viewers a week because it's on a Saturday night. And my head went, oh, that's brilliant, it's on a Saturday, so that means I can carry on working for Unilever. And I did, for the next 5 years.
No.
Yeah. And so I did that, I did the two things together until the start of the Mary Whitehouse Experience. And I think, this is the weird
wow.
thing, I don't think I actually... I mean, this is absolute arrogance of youth, I suppose, or not quite knowing how the world works or whatever it is. But I don't think I ever realised what I was being presented with. I sort of thought of myself at that point as a brand manager who sort of happened to be on BBC One, as opposed to, you know, someone who was, an actor and performer. I know, psychologically, I think that's really strange. I think I was sort of protecting myself for failure somehow, thinking, well, I can always go back and maybe I can swap to body sprays or shampoo, you know.
That is extraordinary. 5 years of the juggle.
Yeah, 5 years. We did, I think Jasper was like 12 weeks a year or so. So it wasn't the whole time. But I also did those 48 weeks of the Mary Whitehouse Experience on the radio whilst working for Unilever. And I used to...
And what did they say in the office? Like, you know, when did they think it was odd that you had this kind of dual existence?
Well, I suspect they did. But you know, what it was very useful, again, for not disappearing up your own fundament, in the sense that when you'd been on Saturday night... You know, that my colleagues would go, oh, I saw it on Saturday. Honestly, it was rubbish. you know, that kind of thing. Kept your feet on the ground.
Grounding.
Yeah, really grounding. Yeah. Really grounding.
So in answer to my question, actually, you never saw your career coming. That's
no,
what
really.
You hadn't anticipated, this extraordinary... CV that you've accrued, which features everything from panel shows and archaeological digs to James Bond. I mean, extraordinary. Really extraordinary.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
But I think that's a sort of, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it means I'm constantly surprised and quite happy.
Pleasantly surprised.
Well, there is that thing, isn't there? If you go, well, my aim is to become the biggest film star in the world, and if you never get there, you're going to, you know, even if you're like the third biggest film star in the world, you're going to be slightly disappointed. Whereas if you're constantly going, ooh, I wonder what's next, you know, you're actually most of the time going to be sort of interested and chuffed, aren't you? Okay, how did that happen? I mean, how did James Bond happen? I mean,
how did James Bond happen?
How did any of it happen?
Was that Phoebe?
Well, I don't know. She denies it, but I suspect that, you know, it must have been in there somewhere, I would have thought. But she said no.
Yeah.
She
said no.
She told me that she hadn't, that nothing, you know, I don't know. I was on a list somewhere of comedians who could sort of act vaguely. I suppose. I don't know. I really don't know how it came about, but I'm delighted that it did come about.
What was that? How many days on set were you for that?
Oh, not very many, actually. I think I did, because all I've got to do is hand over the secret that threatens the world, really, and then get shot in the head. So
simple.
I think we did three, but one of them was...
Right.
One of them was a practice day where I was in a large shed next to the set where I was practising... You know, they couldn't decide whether I was going to be shot in the head or shot in the chest. And but they did know I was going to be shot. So I had to practice different types of death. so I was ready when it came to it.
How do you workshop that in a shed?
Well, you do it with the sort of stunt coordinator who will say,
right,
if you're shot in the chest, you're going to fall backwards slightly. But if you're shot in the head, it's like having the light switched off. So if you're shot in the head, you just go straight down. You're not even aware it's happened to you. It's just you collapse vertically. So we had to practice a lot of that. But probably one of the finest moments of my life, I think, was when this happened. And it was a headshot in the end, although you never saw it. So all this was pointless. But anyway, you never saw it. But the stunt coordinator was watching the scene. I get shot in the head. I go down vertically. They shout, cut. And he was incredibly cool Frenchman, this stunt coordinator. And he came up to me and he tapped me on the shoulder and he went, good death.
Congratulations.
And I'm hoping that's what they say to me when I get to heaven. That's...
Yeah. At least you've already rehearsed the moment. You know, you've had some experience. Yeah.
Well, it's seems to me I'm going to get shot in the head now. Maybe it won't be a headshot.
But let's hope not, because you've not really, really prepped for that. My third and final question for you now, if that's all right, Hugh. I wanted to talk to you about teachers, the people that have taught you the most along the way. And I'm not necessarily talking about the classroom, I'm talking about life's classroom. I know that so much of your comedy career you attribute to your partnership with Steve and the fact that he was the driving force in terms of getting you started. But who else have been big influences on you in your life?
Well, in terms of actual teachers, there was one guy who I've talked about before, in fact, who was the guy that, he was my geography teacher. So I read geography at university.
Got a first.
And the thing about, I did, yeah, which again, well, astonishes me, but no one can ever take
desk.
It away. They can't
desk.
Go back to that paper and go, oh no, hang on. No, we put that down as a B. It was in fact an E in this particular instance. But there was, so, you know, my A-level results, of which we have talked, were sort of surprising because I was predicted much better, really, in my A-levels. And I'm not quite sure what happened, but, you know, it did. And I didn't really do very well at all in terms of being able to go, you know, to Cambridge. And this teacher, his name is Nigel Yates, was just a sort of amazing. He went, well, you know, we've always thought that, you know, that might be where you end up, so you might as well give it a go, mightn't you? And there was an exam. So you did a thing called seventh term. So you did 2 years of A-level and you stayed on for another term and you did the Oxbridge term. And he didn't really have any time in his teaching schedule, or schedule, and I never know which is the American and which is the English pronunciation, so I've said
no,
both.
No, I don't. Yes, thanks.
No, I don't think it matters.
Schedule.
And I wish I'd never mentioned it now.
Yeah.
But he just made time, and he taught, there were five of us who applied, and he made time, and we came in at 7:30 in the morning, or 7 in the morning, to have like an hour and a half before school, and then he taught us after school. And it was just about, it was just sort of about ideas, really. He was just a, he was a guy, you know, geography actually is one of those subjects which is really for people who are interested in everything because they can't really decide what they want to do, I think. So you sort of dip into all sorts of stuff. So, you know, there is no other subject really that takes you from meanders in rivers to the economic geography of the post-Stalinist USSR, which is what I did at university.
Exactly.
It's weird that it's the same subject, isn't it? So it's a sort of scattergun subject. But he was just brilliant and incredibly encouraging and great, and all five of us got in. And I think that sort of is really the moment that changed my life, really, because university isn't really about... There are lots and lots and lots of great universities all over the place. But I think the thing that needs to happen at university is that you've got to meet your people somehow.
Yeah.
And it was at Cambridge that I met my people. Doesn't mean my degree is sort of irrelevant. It's just you know, I met Steve, I met Nick Hancock. I became aware that there was this sort of, you know, 2 years before, 3 years before me was Fryan Laurie and Emma Thompson. And you just suddenly became aware of this sort of world, which you hadn't even thought about.
Yeah.
So he was great. So I learned a lot from him. I've learned an enormous amount from Steve, just in terms of, you know, because he was the sort of, he really was the driving force. He booked all the early gigs and stuff, and he wrote, if I'm honest, he wrote, you know, 90% of the stuff at that point, largely because I was, you know, sniffing different fragrance types, going...
Body sprays.
That one smells bad enough to get into a teenager's bedroom. you know, and he's sort of amazing. And he's sort of amazing in the sense that he's very understanding of that, really. And we've had creative differences, so to speak, but we've never had a sort of a massive falling out where we've kind of, you know, sworn at each other. Wow. And thrown things. Yeah.
That's extraordinary. And you still enjoy his time, right? You still enjoy being around him. And
is he
somebody that you still feel that you learn with, if not from?
Yes. I mean, because that is part of the longevity, indeed, or longevity is a schedule problem again.
Here we go.
I don't know which it is. Of the
Jevity.
Of the Now show.
I'm going to go Jevity.
Jevity. Okay, I'm going Jevity. Is that you sort of have to, you kind of have to be interested in everything, really. It's all about minutiae sometimes when you're doing topical comedy, because a lot of stories aren't funny at all.
No.
And you have to sort of go in and dig and, yeah. And we both enjoy that sort of thing of, you know, working out why things are happening and finding the funny things in stories. And so there's all that.
Is he somebody that still never fails to make you laugh? Because I guess as a comedian, your job is obviously to make others laugh, but it must be wonderful to find somebody who you delight in.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, you need all those things, don't you, for sort of long friendships. And it isn't just a long collaboration. It's a long friendship, really, isn't it? That's what it is. And we've worked together for, say this very quietly, 43 years.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
That's a lot of time. Yeah.
It is. We had Bez on recently, who described his relationship with Sean Ryder in much the same way. Actually what he said is it's a sexless marriage.
Yeah.
We hope.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's sort of right. Yeah, no, exactly. Strange images. But, and I think the other people, you know, from whom I have learnt a lot, actually, I suppose, and most people could say this, I think, would be my mum and dad. So my dad was, my mum was a teacher and my dad was a vicar who sort of became a bishop and all the rest of it. But they never, ever, the thing that they never really seemed to do was they sort of left all the decisions to me, really. So they would never ever go, you know, when I left Unilever, for example, which presumably is quite terrifying for a parent, you know, when your son is leaving something which is actually quite sort of stable.
Yeah.
And doing, you know, I was doing all right, and you leave for something which is sort of, you know, seems a bit more sort of flaky and uncertain. They never ever went, are you sure? They just didn't do that. They never, ever did that kind of stuff. They just went, well, you know, if that's what you want to do, that's what you do. And it was like that my whole life, really. They were very sort of, they were very, very keen that you lived your own life. And I never felt any sort of, I felt enormous amounts of parental support and no parental admonishment, really, and no sort of sense of guilt or, you know.
That's
they never
amazing.
Ever went, for example, why haven't you visited us? I mean, they never ever went, why haven't you phoned? I mean, when I went to, in my first term at university, it's absolutely ridiculous to think about it now, and it's awful. I feel slightly ashamed of it. I didn't phone my parents for the whole first term, right? So I just went to university.
I mean, I know. This is pre-mobile phones, right? So we should give you that. Yeah. But still, come on.
Yeah, I think I mean, they were quite short terms. They were only 8 weeks long. But I'm pretty sure I said goodbye to them when they delivered me, you know, and I got my various boxes out the back of the car. And that was it. That was it until the end of the term. And then when I got home that Christmas or whatever it was, nobody went, phone call would have been nice. No one no one did it. But now, and that wasn't because they weren't interested. It was just because they were sort of, you know, they just thought, well, he's clearly having a nice time. Let's let him get on with it. And then we can hear about it later.
That's very selfless of them. And I guess as well, you know, difficult for them to understand. Certainly with the work that you went on to do, because they both worked in, I'm not going to say the civil service, but they had very secure jobs. Your mother was a teacher, your father was a vicar and then a bishop, you know. And then your brother went off to become a diplomat. So they had two sons, two very bright kids that obviously went very different paths. And they were quite, I would imagine, supportive of both, right?
Yeah, but I've always thought, I mean, they appear to be different paths, right? But I've always thought in a funny kind of way, if your brother's a diplomat and your dad's a bishop and you're on Radio 4, you're all pretty much doing the same thing.
Yeah, you're all swimming in the same waters, aren't you?
Yeah, that's what it feels like.
What about the teachers in terms of your work as an actor? You touched upon Phoebe earlier and how she would kind of pull the rug from beneath you on set and say, yeah, everything you've learned, unlearn it because we're going to do it differently. You've also said before that Claire, who's your partner in life, but for many years was your partner on screen, she taught you the importance of a smaller performance. So who have been your educators as a thespian?
Well, I mean, Claire, certainly, because when we started Outnumbered, I didn't, you know, again, I didn't really feel that I knew what I was doing. So I spent, you know, the first week watching Claire and going, ah, oh, I see. That's what you do. Okay.
I'll do that.
I don't know, really. I mean, I you sort of ought to learn from everyone you work with, oughtn't you? And that's what's really nice about sort of acting. And lots of the things that I've done aren't starry, actually. A lot of them are kind of ensemble. You know, whether it's Mock the Week, where there were always eight people on and there was no... You would never say so-and-so is the... You know, Mock the Week is that person. I don't think you'd ever quite do that. You go, that's a group of, you know, was it eight people? Seven. I can't count. I simply can't count. Three on each side and one in the middle. What's going on? This is why I got
Just like Snow White and her dwarves, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, although there were, technically, there were eight of them if you add in Snow White, right?
Of course, so my bad. Yeah, I'm not Carol Vorderman.
You know, but that's the kind of work I've always enjoyed, actually, is where you're not the out-and-out star, actually. I think it's... And I never have been the out-and-out star. I've always sort of been there, but sort of one rung below.
I think that's a very safe place to play, though, don't you? I really do, because I think that's where longevity lives. I think as well, you've also worked alongside people that have had similar experiences to you. So... the show, the couple next door that you did recently, you played alongside Kate Robbins, who is also an impressionist, which is exactly how you started on Spitting Image all those years back. And then obviously your years of working on Not Going Out with Lee Mack, who, again, like you, was coming from a very different background into effectively acting in a comedy, a sitcom.
Yeah, but I think it's, again, I think it's... You know, one of the sort of the big comic influences on me when I was growing up was Ronnie Barker, I think, because they were sort of like titans at that point, weren't they? You know, the two Ronnies and Morecambe and Wise. But Ronnie Barker was a sort of amazing man, I think, because he could do the two Ronnies, and then I could never quite believe that it was the same bloke being Norman Stanley Fletcher. you know, and he had a very sort of satisfying career going across two worlds of sort of sitcom and effectively, you know, comedy sketch shows. So I always knew it was possible. Lee is exactly the same. Lee's got, you know, got a foot in every possible bit of everything, hasn't he? Because he's great.
Yeah.
And it's people like that and David Mitchell. And I mean, these careers are all, they're all possible. And I met Kate, actually. It was lovely working with Kate on The Couple Next Door because we had done, I don't know, 5 years or something together on Spitting Image. And neither of us have changed. I mean, neither of us look any different now from the early
any
90s.
Older. No, so, totally.
No, totally. No, we're exactly. Yeah.
But it's lovely to see her being kind of picked up again with some really key roles that, you know, Ricky casting her, Ricky Gervais.
Yeah, in Afterlife. She's great.
In Afterlife, which is wonderful. And then you see, you know, the apple never falls far from the tree with young Emily Attack, her daughter. Also showing all the flair that you guys have and hopefully encouraging a new generation to keep, you know, travelling in different lanes. It's lovely stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, careers are difficult things, aren't they? And as we said, they only make sense retrospectively. But I suppose it's sort of, for me, it's always just been, you know, you get sent a thing and you go, well, that sounds interesting. Yeah, maybe I'll do that. And I think I don't ever really want to lose that sort of feeling. I mean, I've been incredibly lucky, but you know, I just want to be interested, really, all the time.
And also, without that attitude, you'd never have hosted Top of the Pops. You'd never have been shot in the head on James Bond, and you would never have had a discussion about multiple orgasms on Fleabag. And that is why your career and your CV are so endlessly fascinating.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I wasn't shot in the head doing Top of the Pops. That's the main thing I'm pleased about.
Also a talking point, potentially. Good luck with the tour. And, I mean, not that you need it. And I really do hope that you enjoy one last, you know, blast around the dance floor before heading back to the day jobs, whatever they look like. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Lovely to talk to you.
My huge thanks to Hugh. You can catch him out on the road with Steve Punt on their We Are Not a Robot tour. Tickets are available wherever you get your tickets. And for more chat with fellow comedians, we have episodes with Tom Allen, Lee Francis, Jack D, Kerry Godleman, Daisy May Cooper, Jenny Eclair, Al Murray, Russell Kane and Adam Kay, all waiting for you in our back catalogue. Oh, before I go, one more thing. Remember, you can always find us on Instagram for all the latest about the show. We're at @whitewine_questiontime. And also, please hit the follow button on Spotify. It's really, really helpful in terms of us being able to find you. I'm going to be back on Tuesday, back on your feeds, to refill your glasses with something from the cellar. Until then, as always, it's been lovely talking with you.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.